The question for the evening is, what is an offer? How do we know an offer? And in order to try and see why that is important, we have to see the kind of mechanics, the imagined mechanics. Now, I say imagined because everything we're about to say tonight, Monday night, we're going to engage in a little bit of the work that a novelist does or an historian does. We're going to try to impose order on the chaos of real life. We're going to create an artificial thing called an offer and an artificial object called an acceptance. The truth is that when people talk and come to an agreement, they have a conversation, you know, that thing that the president keeps on trying to persuade Republicans and Democrats in Congress to have. They're going to have a conversation, and out of that conversation, they hope will emerge agreement. And so one possible view of what happens is that there's a conversation, and then there is agreement. That's a revolutionary concept for the law because that's not the way the law sees it. In an effort to try and figure out whether there is agreement, we create a kind of artificial construct, two constructs. One is called offer, and the other is called acceptance. Once we do that, it requires that we come up with a whole bunch of other rules, like, well, how long is an offer available to be accepted? And when does an offer cease to be available to be accepted? And what constitutes each of the elements of when it can cease to be an offer? So when we go through these definitions, try to keep in mind that they are the devices that the court uses. But when you go to try and apply them to real life, as we're going to see in the cases, it's sometimes not so easy to do. So let's get our terminology straight first. We have an offer. That's the thing that's going to start out this imagined exchange, oral exchange, frequently, sometimes written. And we're going to try to define what that offer is. What we know about it is it's made by a person who, because they made it, is now called the offeror. You'll get used to the use of that. You might have to add offeror and offeree. Those of you who work on a computer, you'll have to probably add that to your dictionary because it'll probably constantly underline those little annoying red dots because the dictionary won't know those words because the dictionary is not a lawyer. For lawyers, however, they seem like the right words to use. Offeror, the person who makes the offer. Offeree, the person to whom the offer is made. So that's the terminology we're going to work with. We have some other terms we'll use, but we can introduce those later. What does the offeror get to do then? Well, the offeror gets to start, gets to form the framework of the agreement. That is, the offeror's job is to come up with what the agreement is going to be. Now, the offeror can't make it into an agreement because the offeror is only one, it takes two to agree, like tangoing. And so the job of the person to whom the offer is made, that's the offeree, their job is to accept. The power of the offeror is to design the agreement. It sounds like almost everything. Except that the power of the offeree is to make the contract. Because as long as it's just the words of the offeror, it has no binding effect on anyone, including, as we'll discover, on the offeror. But the second the offeree says yes, now there's a contract and both are bound. So we're looking at a kind of a, if you want to look at it from a classical international point of view, a kind of balance of power. The power of the offeror to design the agreement, the power of the offeree to actually make it into a legally binding agreement. I make that point because it's a desperate effort on my part to try to make intelligible what is otherwise a rather unintelligible set of legal rules. So keep that kind of framework in mind. But we start out, as I said earlier, trying to decide what is an offer. So let's start with Lonergan versus Skolnick. When the ad appears in the newspaper, and the ad says, quote, Joshua Tree, VIC period, vicinity, presumably. Joshua Tree vicinity, 40 acres, need cash, will sacrifice. It's a small ad. Was it an offer? Or I should put it the other way, shouldn't I? Because we all read the case, so you know it wasn't an offer. Why wasn't it an offer? What does it not tell us that we would need to know in order to say yes? Because that's the game. The game is that we're going to have somebody else, we'll call them the offeree, and the offeree's choice in life is to say yes or no in this artificial structure.
Well, I'd say it wasn't an offer because it didn't have a fixed expression of willingness to sell to later.
Well, let's see. He didn't have a fixed expression to sell. If you're an ordinary reader and you read that ad, does it sound to you as though the guy's ready to sell?
Yes.
Yeah, it sounds desperate to sell, right?
It doesn't have a fixed value. Like, it's not, I'll sell you this property for $1,000. It's no...
Yeah, all it says is need cash. So it's missing a price. So, you know, one of the things that is important when we make a deal to buy or sell is the price. I mean, just minor importance. It's major importance. So you stop and think about that. Well, what is it that an offer would have to be? It'd have to have the price. Maybe. That's for hypothetical discussion. That was the problem here, at least. There was no price. I mean, there may have been some other problems, too, but there was no price. Fixed intention to sell. Well, not to this particular buyer, but when you read it, does it appear to care who buys it? No. So most sellers don't really care who buys, do they? Generally not. No. You're minded to sell whoever offers the price. Ah, the price. We come back to the price. Price is really important. Now, from the standpoint of the buyer, the price is also important, of course, but the buyer... The seller presumably knows what they're selling, but does the buyer know what they would be buying if they said yes? No, how could you? Joshua Tree vicinity. Now, I'm assuming the Joshua Tree is a community, so it gives me some idea of where it's near. But it's like my offering to sell a house in Springfield. Yeah, but what house? It's not an offer until we can identify the subject of the proposed transaction. So we don't know the price, and we don't really have enough to know the subject. Now, we do know something about it, though. We know it's 40 acres. So that's helpful, but of course it doesn't tell us what 40 acres. I assume there are lots of 40 acres around Joshua Tree. There are 40 acres around everywhere. So, not quite enough. And maybe it's a problem that it was in a newspaper. And so I've been talking about the offeree, but who's the offeree here? Anybody. And one of the intriguing questions is, does that matter? And we'll see, this is not an idle question. Does it matter that it's not being made to a specific person? It helps a lot in contract formation rules if the offer is being made to a specific person. It helps a lot. You know who the offeree is. Here, the offeree is presumably anybody who could read the newspaper, and that could be anybody. Indeed, the person who read this newspaper was in New York and the property's in California. Could be anybody. Okay. So, obviously, along the line here, what happened was, you know the facts, what happened here was that the this would-be buyer, Mr. Lonergan, ends up not getting the property because Skolnick ends up selling it to somebody else. We don't know who. And he's taking the position that that represents a breach of contract, but you can only argue breach of contract if you can prove there was a contract. There would be no consideration problem here at all. Consideration would be satisfied because one side's paying money, the other side's delivering property. Hell, no problem at all. But there is a problem here that the court sees about this ad as an offer and says it's not. Now, every time a court sees something that is sort of like an offer, but it doesn't have all the attributes that it needs to have, the court will tend to say, and this is not a formal, this is an informal set of words, they'll say it's an invitation to deal. Or some courts say an invitation to offer. It's not the offer itself, but it's asking the other side to make an offer. So this person is not issuing an offer, they're issuing an invitation, an opening gambit, but it's not an offer. Okay, that's what the court says. So next step. We have now a letter of March 26th from the seller, and this is in response to a letter that he gets from the buyer. The buyer sends a letter, the would-be buyer, Mr. Lonergan, saying that he's interested. We don't know exactly what it says. But then there's a letter that comes back saying, okay, here's a brief description of the property. Here are my directions I had to get there. Here's my rock-bottom price, $2,500 cash. And then it said, this is a form letter. So now after that communication, the question is, well, if the ad in the newspaper was not an offer because it didn't have the price in it, do we now have a price? What's it mean? What does this expression mean? You've probably all used it or heard it used. A rock bottom price. What's that mean?
Nothing lower.
Nothing lower. Does it mean he'd like more?
Yeah.
Yeah, he'd like more. But of course, we all know this is a terrible way of negotiating. Because like, if you say, my rock bottom price is $2,500, well, what do you expect? Who in their right mind is going to now offer a higher price? Now, if two people both offer the $2,500, then sometimes the seller said, well, I'm listening because I have two offers of $2,500. And he's waiting now for something else. If nobody else makes an offer, of course, presumably he can make a deal with whoever offered first or second or whatever other basis he wants to use. Anyway, okay, so we have $2,500, and we can say, look, that's really a price. It's a kind of awkward way of stating it. We'd rather in a contract that somebody said the price is $2,500, but nevertheless, this appears to be a statement that he would accept $2,500, and therefore, for our purpose, there's now a price. All right, how about a location? Do we know enough now? Before we said, Joshua, 40 acres, Joshua Tree vicinity, didn't tell us enough to constitute an offer because nobody could possibly say yes and think they know what they're buying. How about now?
Yeah.
Yeah, now we got it. We have a description of where the property is, how to get to the property, and we have a price. So at this point, it sounds like we have an offer. But the court seems to suggest we don't have an offer. Uh-oh, an offer must require something else. Why don't we have an offer?
Well, the court said there was no meeting of the mind. They didn't actually say, okay.
The trouble with the purview, the trouble with the word meeting of the minds, this is one of these metaphors, of course, that courts love. Meeting of the minds. You have to close your eyes to imagine two minds meeting. I mean, how romantic a soul can you be? Two minds meeting. Do minds ever meet? No. So it's a metaphor. So it's a metaphor for what? Well, I don't know. The formal legal expression, when courts want to sound less metaphorical, is mutual assent. Mutual assent. Or we can use the word that we more commonly use, agreement. Agreement. Meeting of the minds means an agreement, but said metaphorically. But the trouble is that in every case in which you have one party saying there's a contract and the other party saying there is no contract, am I really going to find there was a meeting of the minds? No, I guess I could find that one guy really is just lying. But where there is any gray area here, there's not going to be a clear-cut meeting of the minds. And indeed, if you think back at the cases with which the interpretation chapter began, you know, the guys in the bar selling the property, or the restaurant, the purchase and sale of that property, with one of them apparently three sheets to the wind and the other one trying to take advantage, maybe, or maybe just joking around and then getting serious later, whatever the explanation is. The court decided that was a contract. Was there a meeting of the minds? No. So meeting of the minds is nice to have, but we're not always going to have it in cases where the court's going to describe that it's enough to form a contract. The court will say that the requirements of mutual assent are met. Indeed, the case we're going to talk about tonight are all cases in which there was no meeting of the minds, but in some of them, the court said there was mutual assent. Some. Anyway, so come back to this. Why did the court think there was no meeting of the minds? Because you're right, that's what the court said. But what was the reasoning underlying it? We have the price, we have that which is offered for sale. What more do we need?
Well, then they say that it was because it was a form letter, the same letter had been sent out to numerous parties.
Okay, so that's right. Why does that interfere with the notion of this being an offer? Why is the fact that it's now being on its face addressed to more than one? Of course, that's true. The newspaper ad was addressed to the world, so clearly it was addressed to more than one. The words form letter show that it was this is being sent to more than one person. Why does that matter?
We can't sell the property to more than one person. So if it's an offer, how is he going to offer the same thing to many people and have it be?
Okay. So there's something missing here, and what's missing is figuring out who the offeree is. I mean, so the normal rules of offer and acceptance say that all the offer has to be is fully configured deal, which is to say you have to have the price and you have to have any of the principal attributes of the deal have to be there. But now we find out there's one other thing that's got to be there. We need to know to who is the offeree. When, as you correctly say, there can only be one buyer, because there's only one 40-acre parcel of land. So that's a problem which could potentially affect any offer that is not specifically addressed. So one of our tasks tonight is to see which contracts which are not specifically, which offers which are not specifically addressed can nevertheless be offers, but which cannot be offers, but instead are invitations to deal because they are not individually addressed. How are we to distinguish this from, let's say, the Lefkowitz case, the next case, the first Stoll case? It was an ad that was addressed to the world. The department store was running this ad in the newspaper. Anybody in the world could say yes. But the court doesn't say, oh, well, that's not an offer because it's addressed to the world. How come?
Language first come, first served.
Okay. Because the language itself describes a unique offeree. The uniqueness of the offeree being the first person in line who offers a dollar for the stall. So, and yet, some courts have said, many courts have said, that if I run an ad in the newspaper, so I'll sell my Toyota 2002 Prius for $2,300, that probably sounds too familiar an example to use. And I run that ad in the paper, and somebody calls me and says, I'll buy it. Many courts have said that it's an offer, and by saying, I'll buy it, is my acceptance of the offer. How can that be? What explanation can you give for the court doing that? Because there are many courts that have done that.
Is it because the offeree actually contacted and made, that was the individual exchange between the two? So the person
by implication, what additional element of the offer does that mean is added? What is the offer in effect saying about the issue of who can be the offeree?
The first person who calls them.
Exactly. The first person who says yes. The first person who says yes. So, would that have mattered in this case? Suppose this court had been of the view that the fact that, sure, it says it's a form letter, but all the form letter tells us is that there are numbers of people who are involved. Indeed, in one part of the exchange, the seller says to the buyer, look, you'll have to act quickly because I intend to sell this quickly. And there are other people I'm talking with, which is, of course, exactly what it meant when it said it's a form letter. It's the same kind of communication. There are other potential buyers. Wasn't the seller, in effect, saying, and I'm going to sell it to whoever offers me the $2,500 first? Would it have changed the outcome of this case if the court had reasoned it through that way? And maybe they did. The case is not entirely clear. The opinion is not the clearest opinion I've ever read. So that really takes the next step about what he did. What is it that he did, the buyer? How close did he get to being the person who accepted the offer, assuming it was an offer for a minute, assuming that we can get over the hurdle of the fact that it was a form letter, the fact that it wasn't individually addressed to him, the fact that it didn't explicitly say how amongst the various people who are reading this or who have gotten this description of the property in this form letter, how he's going to decide which one to sell it to. And let's assume that by implication, he's simply going to sell it to the first person who offers the $2,500. What would that do to this case? What problem is there in this case, nevertheless, for this buyer?
The plaintiff isn't the first person to give him the $2,500.
Yeah, isn't that the answer? He's not the first person. Not the first person. The facts say that on April 12th, the defendant sold the property to a third party for $2,500. On April 12th, was there an extant offer, acceptance of the seller's offer to sell the property? Did that exist? When did he try to accept the offer? By what vehicle?
A letter on the 15th.
So even if we, to skip ahead a little bit, even if we were following the infamous mailbox acceptance rule that says that an acceptance is effective when the offeree puts the acceptance in a mailbox, strange rule, even if that were the case and even if that were applicable, that's April 15th and the property was already sold on April the 12th. And therefore, it was too late. It was too late. The offer was an offer which was going to be accepted by somebody buying it for $2,500, and that event had already occurred before this buyer had acted. Now, you have to feel sorry for the buyer, because the problem in part is that the letter of April 8th doesn't arrive till the 14th. So, you know, would he have acted sooner and all the rest of it, you know, but that's a speculation that we can't answer. On what basis is this case ultimately decided? When the court says, oh, well, there has to be a meeting of the minds, and they quote from the restatement, section 25, restatement of contracts first, why was there never a meeting of the minds in the view of the court?
Because the offeror didn't intend it to be an offer. He intended it to be an invitation to negotiate.
That's right. But it was never an offer. It was never an offer. Is that the same view that the trial court had taken?
The trial court also found for the defendant.
Yes, they came out the same way, but was the reasoning the same?
Sure. They thought it was a contract. They just said that he didn't respond in a timely fashion, and that negated.
Well, that it was a contract.
Not a contract. There was an offer.
Yes.
But that because no contract was formed, only because he didn't. They found it wasn't timely.
That's right. They thought there was an offer. There was an offer. But that he had accepted too late. That by the time he had gone to accept it, the offer was no longer available. And the offer was no longer available because the offer terminated, as it appropriately would terminate, by a buyer, one of these many individuals who were the offerees, potential offerees or offerees, and potentially acceptors, but one of them accepted before this one accepted. You get the same result, but on a very different basis, and that makes a difference because it raises the question of, well, then can an ad be an offer? Because this court gets very close to saying an ad can't be an offer. An ad can only be a, quote, mere, you know you're in trouble when you see that word, a mere request for an offer. The trial court had said, no. Yeah, the buyer loses here, but the buyer loses because somebody else had acted first. And in effect, I read this to be a contract which had an offer which said the first person to accept it. And that reasoning is made quite explicit in the Lefkowitz case, where you have the ad itself saying, first come, first serve. So the ad itself identifies who will be the person who will get it. But suppose the ad had simply said, we have one of these for sale. Wouldn't anybody who read that understand that, well, in order to get it, I have to be the first one to tender the dollar, to offer the dollar, because there's only one for sale. So, what do we say about this? Well, we can say a couple of things. We know what the offer has to contain: price or something that's from which price can be calculated. We know that the offer has to identify the object of sale, a description of it in some fashion or another, enough so that the offeree could identify what it is that's being offered. And while it's easier if the offer is being advanced to only one person, it is possible that it's an offer even if it's being advanced to many, although not a certainty. I'll tell you where this comes up most of the time. It doesn't come up most of the time in newspaper ads, although it sometimes does. It comes up a lot in the form of catalogs. So I'm a manufacturer, or I'm a distributor, and I do a catalog every year or every 6 months, and I send it out to thousands of people. I'm trying to sell each thing that's in the catalog. But everybody who gets the catalog knows that I don't have an infinite quantity of each of the items listed in the catalog. I may or may not have enough inventory or ability to manufacture enough to meet all of the demand. In the best of all possible worlds, I have exactly the right inventory to meet exactly the demand, but so lucky, most manufacturers are not. They either have more demand than there are goods, or unfortunately, more goods than there is demand to buy. The courts have been fairly sympathetic about a typical situation which arises. I circulate my catalog is circulated, and I suddenly, it's the hot item. It's the Christmas toy. And I get tons and tons and tons of orders, and I can't fulfill them all. I fulfill some, I run out of inventory. Somebody, I hope not my favorite buyer, whose desire to buy I could not satisfy, now sues me saying, but I sent in my order and that was an acceptance of your offer. The response for the lawyers for the manufacturer distributor, which will prevail, by the way, is going to be, oh no, that was simply an invitation to deal. And all the people who wanted to buy now made offers in response to the invitation to deal. All that happened to you is you made an offer to buy and the seller did not accept your offer. Didn't accept it because there was nothing more to sell. So are we absolutely sure that we know in any case where the offer is addressed to more than one person? Are we absolutely sure we know whether or not it will be treated as an offer or whether it will be treated as an invitation to deal? And the answer is no. No. So what's a turn on? Well, it turns in part, of course, on the intention of the offeror, as you might imagine it would, but it's also going to turn on the reasonable expectations of the offeree, whether or not those are the same as the intention of the offeror. Because what else is there? What else do we have to rely upon? I'll show you a great example of this problem, which I think is sort of, in a way, unintentionally introduced by the authors of this casebook. Take a look at the note on page 424. And he quotes a Minneapolis appeals court in 1995. That's not that long ago. We do not believe people intend to be legally bound when they make reservations at a restaurant or schedule appointments to have their car repaired, their hair cut, or their teeth checked. Any of you miss a dentist appointment recently? To get a bill? You bet. You bet. What happened? Well, cultural expectations change. The medical profession has changed this part. It used to be true. If you missed a doctor's appointment, well, you were expected to call up and apologize. Now, you don't give 24 hours advance notice. You better expect to be billed. Not only that, but it's a bill your insurance company won't cover. What happened? Could that happen to restaurants? To hotels? Sure could. Even car repair shops. Hasn't yet, but that doesn't mean it will. Well, what changes? Well, when cultural expectations change, presumably the law has to change. Why? Well, because the only thing we can look at is the intention of the offeror and the reasonable expectations of the offeree. What else is there to rely upon? And both of those are going to be affected, influenced in the mind of the court by what they believe are the appropriate cultural expectations of the parties. Interesting problem. Very interesting problem. Now, let me ask you this. One of the curiosities about the Lefkowitz case, there are many, but in some ways the most interesting, in some ways, is the problem of the second offer and the second acceptance of that offer. What do you think about the department store's argument that, well, he may not have known the house rule when he came to answer and therefore accept the first offer, but he certainly did know the house rule being women purchasers only for women's garments, that he didn't know it, and therefore he was a proper person, his acceptance was proper with respect to the second. They said, no, it couldn't be because he already knew the house rule. Now, they made that argument, right? But the court obviously rejected that argument. Right? And they said, no, you have to pay. You breached the contract. Indeed, it was the only one that they could really get damages for, because the first one, the court said, damages are speculative. And, if damages are speculative, you can't get them. It's a basic remedy rule. I'm not sure I agree with that, but anyway, that's what the court said. So the second one was not speculative, because there you had a fixed value, $139.50 or whatever it was. So they said, now we have an exact figure, and therefore now we can award damages. But remember that the department store said, well, whatever you think about the first one, the second one, he knew that he was not a proper person to accept, and he knew that. The court implicitly rejects that argument by not mentioning it. That's one way for a court to reject your argument. You don't ever want to be rejected that way. It's a real downer. Say to the court, at least reject my argument. Give me some fake reason for rejecting my argument, but at least, I made a good argument. I'm entitled to have it answered. Why do you think?
Well, I think it's reasonable if I were that guy, I'm sorry, if I were Lefkowitz, okay, if I made a mistake, then I would expect the next ad next week maybe to read first come, first woman, first served, or something like that. But now I think, hey, maybe they're open-minded.
That's right. I think that's exactly right. I think that's exactly right. I feel totally unpersuaded by it, but I think that's the argument. But I can tell that you feel persuaded by it. But then it's your argument, so you're prejudiced. Okay. So then you look at Ford Motor Car Company. Now, the Ford Motor Credit versus Russell, the case on page 419. You notice what jurisdiction we're in? Minnesota. And what level of court do we have? It says, court app. Min court app. So it is an intermediate appellate court. Okay? And which court decided Lefkowitz? The Supreme Court of Minnesota. Right? So the big boss says that the law in Minnesota is the law in Minnesota. That's their job. That's the power they have. And this is a appellate court, 1994. Are these cases consistent? Is there a view about offer and acceptance? They say here, the advertisement here did not constitute an offer of sale to the general public. Which part of this leads to that conclusion? I read that there was an advertisement in a local newspaper to sell a Ford Escort Pony, whatever that is, for $7,826. with monthly payments of $159.29 based on 11% financing. They never delivered that package to the guy who came in to buy it. This court says, we conclude the advertisement here did not constitute an offer of sale to the general public. Why not?
Because it was unreasonable to expect every person that walked in to be able to get that financing.
Wait a second. Who's being unreasonable?
Well, whoever buyers. It would be unreasonable for a buyer to walk in expecting to get that financing right off the bat.
Uh-huh. So that Russell should have understood that in order to walk in to be a qualified offeree, he would have to be qualified for 11% financing. Does that mean this was not an offer? The court said not an offer. Is this case consistent with the Lefkowitz case?
I think it's consistent just because the facts are just, it's a different set of facts. I think like, because of the cultural expectations, the court is saying that people wouldn't interpret that as an offer because most people understand that financing isn't available to everyone.
Suppose that my client is actually a person who's qualified for 11% financing, but for whatever reason, they don't want to do business with me. And so they say, no, we're not going to sell you that pony. And I say, I've always wanted a pony.
I think according to the court's reasoning, it's still not an offer because according to normal expectations, the way people would interpret what they're saying, people wouldn't see this as an intent to create power of acceptance in everyone.
And is that view consistent with Lefkowitz?
I don't see it as conflicting because the facts are different. But I think...
Suppose that they said in the ad, first come, first served. And I'm the first guy through the door, and I have qualified for 11% financing, and they don't sell me the car. Have I got action for breach of contract against these people or not? Am I making you squirm just a little bit?
Good, yes.
Yes.
The offeree has to come in and perform by being the first come, first serve, or being credit qualified.
Okay, but that doesn't answer the question of whether it's an offer. It only answers the question of whether or not it's a valid acceptance. So that I understand the argument here that you can say about this particular guy that he was not the offeree for whom this offer is being made. Because the offer is in fact addressed to the first person who meets the qualifications of being eligible for 11% financing. He's the first person with that qualification who comes in and says yes. So that's what you're describing as performance part. He has to be the qualified offeree. But my question is it an offer though? Is the fact that it says, I'm only going to sell to 11%. Suppose that the ad from Lefkowitz, the second ad, said, along with Marie's suggestion, this is available only to women. So this guy, Shamil, shows up first, and they said, no, I'm not going to sell you because you're a man, and the ad says, woman. The person right behind him is a woman, and she says, I want it. For whatever reason, she's a person who's been a real troublemaker, and the store doesn't feel like giving her the benefit of this deal, and they say, no, not you. And she says, what do you mean, not me? You made an offer. I accepted the offer. Therefore, if you don't sell me that thing for a dollar, that stole for a dollar, that's a breach of contract. So sure, I'm agreeing that he doesn't have a very good case because he did not qualify for 11% financing, and although it's worded actually kind of weirdly, because it sounds like they're promising 11% financing when in fact they didn't mean that. Okay, I'll give that to the court, And we'll say, let's interpret it in fairness to the advertiser, although the usual rule, of course, is, as we'll see, the burden's on the offeror, and if the offeror screws up, that's the burden is the offeror. Be careful what you say. But let's give it to the offeror. We'll be liberal and generous, and we'll say, no, properly read by the reader, it says, if you qualify for 11% financing, we'll sell you this Ford Pony for whatever the price was. And I'm supposing that they turn the person down, they refuse to make a contract with them, they refuse to sell them. This court says that's not an offer. So in the case that I'm posing, you would have to say, hey, it wasn't an offer, and so there can't be a breach. The person who came in to buy was, in fact, the offeror, because this is just an invitation to offer. This potential buyer was coming in and making an offer, and they were rejecting the offer. They're free. Everybody is free to reject offers. However, once you're an offeror, you're not free to accept acceptances once the acceptance is made. Well, you may disagree, but I think this case is inconsistent with, I think you can come to the same result simply by saying, no, he didn't fit because we read this and we think he should have read it to mean you have to be qualified for 11% financing or else this offer is not being made to you. You are not, therefore, a person who is an offeree within this offer. To be an offeree within this offer, you have to be qualified for 11% financing.
Isn't the distinction first come, first served in the Lefkowitz case as opposed to, I mean, that's what I said.
But I raised the question before, and I think that's a fair point, Mike, but I raised the question before about whether or not we take this seriously or not. Most courts would say that if I advertise and say, I have a 2002 Prius with 145,000 miles on it, I'll sell for $2,300, and that's all it says, that would be treated as an offer. If you call up and say, I want that car, I'll pay you $2,300, I can't do anything about it. You've accepted my offer. In most jurisdictions, most courts would say that. I think that's true in Minneapolis and Minnesota, too. And I think the court is just wrong here. And I get there only by saying, I admit, I get there only by saying that newspaper ads have implicitly in them, again, as a cultural understanding, that frequently, and particularly this kind of ad, where it's identifying one thing, that the expectation on the part of any reasonable person reading it is that there's only one, and that it's going to go to the first person who makes that offer of the right amount. That's the assumption that people are going to make. I think that's not an unreasonable assumption to make. If you read that ad, that's certainly what you would think of it. Yeah.
I just have a question. Does it matter that Ford Motor Credit was not the party that put the ad in the paper, that they were just the ones who had the rights assigned to
them? No. I don't think it mattered to the court at all. Not that the court tells us, and I don't think that it should matter. Okay. So you see the Donovan case, a California case now, in 2001, a fairly recent case, saying some courts have stated that an advertisement other than notice of the paper does not constitute an offer, rather it's presumed to be an invitation to consider. Nevertheless, certain advertisements held to constitute offers where they invite performance of a specific act without further communication and leave nothing for negotiation. And they identify advertisements for rewards, and we will talk about some rewards cases. But they are far from the only ones. And you notice that they cite the Lefkowitz case because of the first term, first serve. The Harris versus Time, that's a case we looked at talking about consideration, the person who opens the envelope from Time because he thinks he's going to get a watch and it turns out that he's not qualified. An ad saying you could exchange a 1954 car for a 1955 car was an offer, and so on. So there are a whole series of these cases in which courts have, in fact, treated advertisements as offers. There are also cases where the courts declined to treat advertisements as offers. And generally, the ground upon which they've done it is that, well, if it's addressed to the public and not to a particular offeree, it must be an invitation to deal and not an offer because it lacks that attribute of offers, which is the ability to identify an offeree, except there are all these exceptions, and nobody knows what the limiting rule is, which gives you the basis of whether exception applies, and therefore it's not, therefore it is an offer. Okay. Auctions. auctions represent a particular kind of sale transaction. I take it most of you have probably at some point in your life either attended an auction or participated in one on eBay or some other internet auction house. There are a set of assumptions made about auctions, and there are actually now quite a few fairly specific statutory rules about auctions, including 2-328 of the Uniform Commercial Code. Since generally speaking, auctions involve goods, although not always, obviously many auctions, most auctions, fall within Article 2 of the Uniform Commercial Code. And the problems with auctions that have occurred are, first of all, kind of, we have to apply the rules of offer and acceptance. So courts say that when the auctioneer puts up for sale an item on the auction block, that is an offer. Who could accept it? Well, at an auction, the general rule is the person who accepts it is the highest bid still standing at the point that the offer, that the hammer falls on the offer. The offeror says, the auctioneer says, okay, that's it, it's yours. That sounds plain enough, but there are at least two problems which have come up fairly regularly. The first problem is an easy one, and maybe it's happened to you, and that's when the offeror stops the bidding and takes the item off the auction and says, no, we're not going to sell it, and does this after there are already bids. And the person who's made the highest bid says, no, wait a second, my bid was an acceptance of your offer. Therefore, the contract is mine. I understand that I could have lost that contract. It's kind of a, it's almost mine, but I could have lost it if somebody else had made a higher bid, because then it would have been theirs. But nobody made a higher bid. Therefore, it's mine, and you can't take it off the block. The reason that the offeror, the auctioneer, has done that is that whoever owned the property, and it could be the auctioneer's own property, you rarely know, or it could be somebody else's for whom the auction is being done, has said, no, I don't want to sell it for less than a particular price. And the auctioneer believes that this bidding is not going to reach that price. And so they yank it from the auction block. That is called a reserve, an auction on reserve. And it has a its specific statutory recognition, but the auctioneer must, in the listing of the goods that are going to be sold, has to flag it and say that there is a reserve price. They don't have to tell you what the reserve price is, but they have to tell you that there is a reserve. So you have at least a reasonable notice of the fact that, well, maybe it's not exactly an offer that you can accept. That's probably happened to you on eBay. Most things that are for sale on eBay also are for sale with reserve prices. Not all, but many of them are. The other more interesting problem and more troublesome one goes like this. I'm offering this book, right? And I have an offer of $5 over here, an offer of $10 over here, and I say, sold for $10. And the person who offered $10 says, no, I changed my mind. I don't want it. I swivel around and I say to the $5 one, I accept your offer of $5. After all, that was an offer. I had never rejected that offer. Well, or maybe I had. Courts have said in general that the character of auctions goes something like this. when there's an offer of 10 after you've offered 5, you could, of course, since your offer of 5 has not been accepted by the auctioneer, you could, of course, still withdraw the offer, because an offeror can withdraw the offer, as we'll learn, at any moment up to the time that it's accepted. And so your offer has not been accepted, and therefore it can be withdrawn, and you would have withdrawn it, except for the fact that there was no need to withdraw it because somebody else had bid 10, and so you knew that you were not going to be buying it. So even if you had that, by that time, thought to yourself, oh, thank God somebody bid 10. I really didn't want that. I already have 5 of those. What was I thinking? And therefore, you would have withdrawn the offer, but you didn't bother withdrawing the offer because you figured that with the $10 bid having been made, that it was never going to come to you in any event. So the courts have said any higher bid, in effect, terminates the availability of the lower bids to be offers. They are extinguished. They are extinguished. We're going to learn a whole lot of ways in which offers can be extinguished now. In auctions, an offer is extinguished by simply being superseded by a higher offer. Or I should say, I'm sorry, a higher acceptance. But the general subject is, as I say, how long do offers live? And that, of course, is the subject of Akers versus J.B. Sedbury, how long do offers live? And we're going to think a lot about this question, because one of the typical battles between people who are perhaps offerors and those who are perhaps offerees is that the offeror now doesn't want the deal, and so the offeror wants to take the position that that was not an effective acceptance, and the only reason why it couldn't be an effective acceptance is that the offer was no longer available. So how can an offer no longer be available once the offer's made? Well, I've already identified one way the offeror can withdraw the offer. So write down for yourself, one of the ways that offers die is that they are withdrawn by the offeror. When can the offeror withdraw the offer? At any time up to the moment of acceptance. We haven't talked about what acceptance is exactly yet, but we will. We'll get there. But that's not the only way in which offers die. So we'll look at Akers versus J.B. Sedbury. This talks about a lot about that particular problem. You remember that a couple of guys come in to the owner of an establishment. They say to her, look, we need to have a conference with you. We want to be perfectly honest. We'll talk about something that's difficult for us and it's difficult for you. But the guy who you have running your plant at which we work is at the very least incompetent and maybe worse. But before we say that, we're going to say we want you to take us seriously, and so in order to make sure that you understand the seriousness that we attach to this, we hereby tender our resignations. If you want, you can terminate our, they were not employees at will, they're employees for term, period of time. You can accept our resignations if you want to, but hear us out, because we are serious. She hears them out. Tries to get the guy on the phone, but she can't while they're there. She hears them out. They leave. She says nothing about their resignations. They get back to the factory, and they get a telegram saying, we accept your resignation. You're out of a job. Go, leave. For the court, the question is, they made an offer. No doubt about it, it's an offer. She did accept the offer. And therefore, their resignations are effective unless the acceptance was too late. Was it too late? Yes. Why? Did a very long period of time pass? Months, years?
Probably
didn't the court say that when they made the offer, their understanding was that it would be accepted either immediately or at least by the end of their meeting, and it wasn't an offer that was just out there for the end of time?
Okay. So the court says, that, well, we read the offer, it doesn't say when it will terminate. Can offers say when they'll terminate? Yes. But we think that by the time they left and she had not accepted it, we think that it was no longer available. So they propound a rule, quote unquote, be careful of such rules. The rule is, oh, well, when an offer is made face to face, then it terminates at the end of the face to face meeting. Is that really a good rule? No, really not. It's sort of a make-weight rule, but it better put the way you just put it. That is, in this circumstance, a reasonable person, in the form of these two engineers, a reasonable person would believe that if their acceptance, if their resignation was going to be accepted, it would be during this conversation. Indeed, the court actually says that we think she actually rejected it during the conversation. Remember, there was a conflict in testimony about that. So, but they're content to do it either way. That is, either she rejected it, or they reasonably understood that she rejected it, or that they were of the reasonable view that the offer was available only so long as they were there. Now, why is that important? Well, it's important because that's a way of saying, look, they could have withdrawn the offer. It had not been accepted. So on the way out, they could have said, oh, yeah, remember our offer? Forget about it. But they didn't feel that was necessary because they felt that it was clear that if it was going to be accepted, it would be accepted during the course of the conversation. It was that kind of situation. So a little bit of judicial psychology here, or psychoanalysis, saying what could reasonable parties have believed? What do we think that they reasonably believed? And so they testified with it. So what should she have done? Suppose that, look, she's just taken over, she's a widow, she's just taken over the operation, she's really dependent upon this guy who's running the plant, they're telling stories about him, she's not really sure what to do, she wants to consult with him, she tries, but he's not around, that should have told her something, that he's not around to talk to. What should she have done under these circumstances?
She should have mentioned that she was waiting to hear back from somebody else.
She should have said something which indicated that for her, the issue was still alive. So suppose she said on the way out, well, as for your offers of resignation, I'm going to give that some further thought. And what would they have said? Forget it. Forget it. We said we wanted you to take us seriously. You've heard what we had to say. We withdraw those offers. Could they have withdrawn the offers? Of course. Because the offers had not been accepted. And therefore, they're entitled to withdraw them anytime they want, up until the time it's accepted. Now, the court thought that one of the things that happened during the conversation was that she, in effect, rejected or said words which a reasonable person would have regarded as rejections of the offer. Keep in mind now, reasonable conversations, reasonable expectations, reasonable people goes back to our conversations about the first part of Chapter 9, or interpretation. This notion that the court is responding to what they reasonably understand is another example of the fact that when the court's dealing with offerors, the court is prepared to put the burdens of clarity on the offeror. If there's a lack of clarity, that offeror is going to burden, that lack of clarity is going to burden the offeror and not the offeree. Why? Because they have control. The offeror is entitled to do it any way they want. Now, here they were the offerors. Well, aren't they burdened with lack of clarity? Didn't they fail to make it clear for how long those offers would be pending? Probably so. And I think that's why the court says, well, we think that she really rejected it during the course of the conversation. The effect of a rejection of an offer is to terminate the offer. Why? Well, this is a little like the theory of the auction. if somebody tells you, no, I reject your offer, even if I said, let's suppose they had said to her, we're going to make this offer, you can accept it any time within the next 2 weeks. That's what they said to her. We know that you need to think it over, you have 2 weeks to think it over. And she says, during the course of the conversation, she said, look, I'm not going to accept your offer to terminate. That's unnecessary. I understand where you're at, you know, and I will think over what you've said. But don't talk about resigning. I don't want you to resign. Now, even though they had initially said she had 2 weeks to think it over, once she rejects the offer, the court will not burden them by saying, but you said she had 2 weeks. Because after all, they said she had 2 weeks, but could they have said, oh yeah, you know, we said you had 2 weeks, but forget about it, we withdraw the offers? The answer is yes. What would she have had to do in order to provide assurance that she would have a full 2 weeks? Is there anything she could have done?
Can she state that she's keeping the 2 weeks? Can she say or ask, I still want the 2 weeks to think it over?
Well, she could say that, but on the other hand, could they say, no, the offer is finished? She said, well, you said I had 2 weeks. And they said, well, that was what we said then. What we say now is our offer is withdrawn. We're still the offeror. We have the right to withdraw our offer.
She could have said, I will give you my answer in 2 weeks. I can give you my answer in 2 weeks.
Well, yeah, but they say, yeah, well, answer to what? We've withdrawn our offer, lady.
Oh, I thought they had
to say. No,
they have to say. Could she have made some sort of counteroffer?
Well, you can always make a counteroffer. But, you know, they are unlikely to be minded to.
She can give some additional consideration.
Consideration. You see, it doesn't go away just because the fall is over. Yeah, exactly. Good. Yeah, and what do we call that then? I'm giving consideration. I'm going to pay you money to keep your offer so your offer will be available for 2 weeks. Yeah, it's an option contract. It's exactly what it is. So another way of saying that is an option is an irrevocable offer. All offers are irrevocable except when they become options. How do they become options? You get paid for them. Now, that's not realistic. I don't mean to suggest that that would have been a realistic part of this transaction. Never would have happened. Clearly, its problem is they got hung up on their own rhetoric, right? Saying, oh, well, we'll offer our tender our resignations in order to get somebody to take you seriously. That's not too bright. Right? That's not too smart. And it said clearly just because they wanted to be taken seriously, and this was their way of drawing her attention to how serious a problem they thought it was. And rhetorically, it's lovely, but it ended, you know, it had a bad potential for them, which they avoided only because the court was nice enough to say, oh, well, we think you rejected the offer that they made, and that rejection during the conversation terminates your power of acceptance. That's the way it's said. A rejection terminates the power of acceptance. Rejection by the offeree terminates the offeree's power of acceptance. Or they were prepared to say the other. Namely, even if there was no rejection during the conversation, an offer doesn't last forever. How long it lasts depends upon the reasonable expectations of parties. The reasonable expectation of parties to a face-to-face conversation is that it will be accepted or not during the conversation. And if it's not, the offer terminates of old age. It died of old age. How much age is old age? It depends. The court's saying this was a death by old age. So there are a variety of ways about offers die. You can see it on top of page 427, the language an offer may be terminated a number of ways, as for example, where it's rejected by the offeree, which the court thought actually happened here, or where it is not accepted by him within the time fixed. Well, there's no time fixed here. Or if no time is fixed, within a reasonable time. An offer terminated in either of these ways ceases to exist and cannot therefore be accepted, and that's a quote from Williston on contracts. So this case is an example of both. The court thought that it was in fact rejected by the offeree, but in the alternative, the court thought that a reasonable time had expired at the end of the conversation, and therefore it was too late to accept the offer. Let me ask you this. Did this last argument by the defendants pass the blush test? Here's an argument. Finally, defendants contend that if complainants are entitled to any recovery at all, such recovery should have been limited to the 90-day period from and after October 2, 1950, because complainants themselves admitted that they had offered to resign upon 90 days' notice with pay for that period. A terrible argument. Just awful. I know desperation sometimes makes lawyers say silly things, but, you know, you think about all these arguments, but you have to draw the line somewhere and say, oh, no, I'm not going to make that argument. That's just too stupid. I mean, this depends upon whether or not there was a contract. Obviously, if you win that one, you win the argument and you get their resignations. And if you lose it, you can't make this argument because this argument contradicts the very finding that was necessary in order to decide against you in your principal argument. This is just silly. It's just silly. Okay, we'll move on from there. See you. We're finally going to get a Monday night class. Yeah. So we'll see you Monday night.
Maybe.
I am making appointments for folks who want to see me, so keep the emails coming, and I'll try to get through everybody as quickly as I can.